You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A report issued last week by the American Academy of Arts and Science entitled War with Iraq, Costs, Consequences, and Alternatives found that the political, military, and economic consequences of war with Iraq could be extremely costly, far more than is being estimated by the Bush administration. Professor William Nordhaus of Yale University projects that in the worst-case scenario, the total cost of war with Iraq could be as high as $1.9 trillion, and asserts further that the administration has failed to articulate the full economic impact of this war on the U.S. economy and the potential for global ramifications.
The main difference between these estimates and the ones that are commonly used, as I said, is they include not just direct military costs, but also the post-war costs, occupation, peacekeeping, reconstruction, nation-building, humanitarian assistance, and also then the indirect costs on the economy through impacts on oil markets and on the overall economy.
Now, how do your figures compare with what the administration is estimating and what other analysts are predicting?
The administration's numbers are tragicomic in the sense that they never have come up with any official numbers. The only numbers that the administration has produced are ones by the White House economic advisor, Larry Lindsey. And his numbers were actually $100 to $200 billion, and the $200 billion was the top outside number that he came up with. But you might say that that was not authorized because as of today he's no longer with the administration. And some of the stories report that part of the unhappiness was actually that he blurted out the truth, or what they thought was the truth, on the cost of Iraq.
So even his estimate doesn't touch what your high mark.
Well, again,
is.
He probably was talking about the military costs only.
Well, how would you estimate military costs?
Yeah, my military cost numbers were a low of about $50 billion and a high of $140 billion. Mm-hmm. So they're close to the range that Larry Lindsey had. But the difference is that his numbers, as far as we can tell, didn't include all the other impacts of a war, and those numbers are the ones that really get into big numbers.
Now, we did see where last week President Bush, he fired his Treasury Secretary as well as his top economic advisor. What's the connection, if any, between the economy and wartime?
It's actually a kind of complicated connection. I would say there are little wars and big wars. If we take the big wars of our history, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, those wars actually provided boosts to the economy, and the reason was they were actually accompanied by very sizable buildups and expenditures on the war. So there might be 5% of the economy or 10% of the economy would be devoted just to wartime spending. In the little wars that we've seen, and if you look, say, a little war like the first Persian Gulf War of 1990-1991, there's a relatively small increase in wartime spending. And without the boost that came from that, actually during the 1990-91 period, there was a recession and the economy actually turned down. And I think the way to think about that is that you have the military spending, which is a plus to the economy, or boost to the economy, I should say. And then you have psychological factors, which can go any direction. And in the 1991 period, the psychological reaction was actually very, very negative, and the economy was sent into a recession.
Psychological meaning the impact that it's having on the American people and their spending?
Yeah, there are actually a number of different things. I think it's very, very clear if you look back at the 1990 period that after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, there was a very, very sharp drop in what's called consumer sentiment, and that's basically you ask consumers, how are you feeling about your incomes? Are you feeling you're going to buy some major items like a car or a refrigerator? And how do you think your economic prospects are? And after the 1990 war started, that drop in consumer sentiment was just really terribly sharp.
So psychologically, Americans were depressed?
Well, they weren't depressed. I think you'd say they were frightened, and they were anxious, and they were concerned. And so as a result of that, they basically reduced their spending. There also was a pretty sharp drop in stock prices during that period. The stock market went down about 15% in 3 months. So those are the psychological factors that are at work.
So if we're talking about a war with a price tag of about $99 billion, best case scenario from the U.S. perspective, does that fall into the category of a big war or a little war?
That's small. I mean, in the most favorable scenario, it's small by historical standards.
That's small potatoes.
Well, with it, small potatoes. You know, we're talking about roughly $1,000 per household in the United States. So these are not trivial numbers. I
mean, that's how much it's costing Americans, the $99
billion? $99 billion, roughly. It's a little under that. But roughly, you can think of the price tag of this in the low, short, and favorable, that's favorable to the United States case, of roughly $1,000 a household. And if you're getting to the high-cost case, you're talking almost $20,000 per household over the next decade.
And so if this is a small war or a little war in your terms, then there's a chance that the economy may not be boosted.
Well, I think my own view is that if you have the short and favorable war, sort of everything breaks in the U.S. favor, then it's a small cost. And
now, how does oil factor into this whole equation? Because obviously, clearly, the oil markets would be affected if we go to war with Iraq.
Well, again, here, what I do is separate into what I call a kind of a bad case and then a more happy case. If you talk to experts in oil markets now, they think there is probably a premium, what they call a war premium, on oil prices that reflect normal price plus a little bit because of the possibility that oil markets will be disrupted. So if in the case where things come out favorably, then there probably would be a small decline in oil prices. But the thing that I think is of major concern to many economists is if things get nasty, and there are lots of ways they can, then you could see a very sharp spike in oil prices, $50, $75, $100 a barrel. So really big price increases over some period of time.
And how might that play out in the lifestyle of the American consumer?
Basically, what happens is you have a shortage of some kind. You see a spike in oil prices. So one of the cases that I analyzed in the paper was a spike from about $25 a barrel to $75 a barrel. And there we're talking about gasoline prices up by about $1.20 a gallon. So if you're paying $1.60 a gallon now, you'd be paying $2.80 a gallon after that spike went up. So those are very, very big numbers. And what we've seen in the past, when you get these spikes in oil prices, what happens is you have a downturn in the economy. You have inflation, you have high interest rates, you have high unemployment, high inflation, and a recession.
And so clearly the Bush administration is not envisioning that scenario. What might they be envisioning?
You know, I've talked to some people in the Bush administration, and they're very tight-lipped. My own sense is they're hoping for something that's on the happier side, that would actually have a decline in oil prices.
In other words, we would have to gain control of Iraq's oil?
Well, again, there are lots of different scenarios. I think what would happen, I mean, the first thing that would happen if, in fact, you had a favorable outcome would be that the sanctions would be taken off Iraq. They could return to full production and full level of exports. That wouldn't mean a lot. That would mean a little bit of oil from that. But then they might, over the next 5 years or decade, build up their oil production and begin to export more.
Professor William D. Nordhaus of Yale University. President-elect Bush has appointed Elliot Abrams as his new director of Middle Eastern Affairs, and speculation is growing that he will be responsible for the occupation and reconstruction of Iraq if there is a war. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International accused Abrams of complicity in the operation and cover-up of death squads in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. According to Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, co-host of Taking Aim, heard on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, if there is a war with Iraq, we can expect a return of the death squads.
A key part of the $1.9 trillion estimate by William Nordhaus of the cost to the United States for a war against Iraq is the occupation of Iraq. And President Bush just appointed the notorious Elliot Abrams to be his new director of Middle Eastern Affairs. And one of the tasks that Elliot Abrams will have will be to oversee the long occupation and reconstruction of Iraq. Ralph?
Maya, Elliot Abrams, of course, has a history that is known to many. He was the Reagan appointee as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the early 1980s and then Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs, and was exposed by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International of having both directed and covered up the death squad operations of the United States government in El Salvador, Guatemala, and in Honduras. He has a very particular association, and that is with the Wolfowitz, Pearl, Armitage, Cabal, and part of the Project for the New American Century, which was the center for the preparation of the campaign against terror, which was begun already in the 1970s, already preparing for the fragmentation of Iraq, along the lines of the plans of the Mossad, as expressed in the Oded Yinon plan, a strategy for the 1980s that called for the fragmentation of each Arab and Middle Eastern country in turn and the capture of their resources. He's the point man.
It was Elliot Abrams who was President Bush's point man at the United Nations, pressuring UN Ambassador Negroponte to make sure that there weren't too many concessions to the Europeans on the resolution, the UN resolution, maintaining the U.S.
Well, the
put-in
language, the language that was designed by Abrams at the behest of Wolfowitz and Pearl and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush was to assure that no matter what the UN resolution said, it would provide language that would allow the U.S. to attack Iraq and seize its oil.
Seize oil, the true context, because, as has been pointed out by the U.S. Energy Agency, Iraq has, with its reserves and the unexplored areas of Iraq, enough oil to provide for U.S. imports for 100 years, for a century. So the occupation of Iraq and the control of Iraq is key for U.S. policies, the control of that oil. Now, Colin Powell and the State Department and the CIA are planning a prolonged occupation of at least 10 years, a la the occupation of Japan, where Douglas MacArthur, General Douglas MacArthur, was put in place. And it would be General Tommy R. Franks, the commander of the U.S. troops in the Persian Gulf, or one of his subordinates who would be the commander. But now that we have Abrams as the director for Middle East Affairs, we may see coming to the front another plan, and that has been exposed by STRATFOR, the U.S. Intelligence and Analysts Agency. And what STRATFOR has mentioned is that there is a direct plan from Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz for the breakup of Iraq into three sections, a part near Baghdad, the Sunni part of Iraq, to be aligned with the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, for the north to be an autonomous Kurdish state, complete with many U.S. army bases, and also for the Shia south to be ceded over to Kuwait.
Well, Maya, that was outlined, as you describe it, in the New York Times on the 11th of October, and in the New York Times piece on December 7th, where the article about Abrams being at the center of the Middle Eastern policy of the administration is set forth, it's made very clear that what he is carrying forth is the plan that he has supported with Wolfowitz and Pearl since the last quarter of a century, and the consequences of that for Iraq are unimaginably terrible because it means death squads once again. That's what this administration is pursuing. That's the meaning of the occupation of this small, impoverished country. This is Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen.
And everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace, not afraid. And everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and
hundreds
not
of people
afraid.
Gathered in a Baltimore church on Sunday night to pay their last respects to renowned peace activist Philip Berrigan, who passed away from cancer Friday evening, surrounded by his family and community.
He was 79. Philip Berrigan and his brother Dan, both Catholic priests, gained national prominence for opposing the Vietnam War and by burning draft files with homemade napalm. Rooted in his faith, Philip's commitment to resisting U.S. militarism continued. With the support of his community, he was arrested over 100 times and spent 11 years of his life behind bars for nonviolent civil resistance. Pacifica's Peace Watch producer Laurel Padgett-Seekins brings us this reflection on his life.
I'm a World War II veteran. I was commissioned as an infantry officer in France in 1944. Because of my involvement in the military for about 3.5 years and my participation in the European theater of operations, I had to slowly unlearn many of the lessons and falsehoods that I had picked up. This took a long and laborious course. I came home and at the behest of my family went to Holy Cross College, and then entered the Josephite Seminary in the same year. And after 5 years, I was ordained a Catholic priest. And then my true education began, I believe. Our apostolate was to African Americans, and most of our missions and schools were in the Deep South. Black people began to educate me. So I joined the civil rights struggle and became active in the Deep South. In Selma, Alabama, in New Orleans, Montgomery, Alabama, and many other places. From that, I learned about the war in Vietnam and African-American participation in it. While teaching in New Orleans at a black high school, I saw my students recruited by the Air Force and by the Army and Marines and other branches of the service, thinking nothing of it in those days. But nonetheless, the lessons of the civil rights movement struck deeply into me and found a chord of response, especially the nonviolence of Martin Luther King. He, in turn, of course, was highly influenced by the nonviolence of Jesus and by Gandhi. In a very true sense, the civil rights leaders taught me. I became active against the war in about 1962. Through legal measures, mostly. I did not learn about civil disobedience until the mid-60s. In 1967, while the March on the Pentagon happened, I went with three other friends to the Baltimore Customs House, and we poured our blood on 1A draft files. For this, we were indicted, went to trial, while Baltimore and Washington and New York City and other major American cities burned because of the assassination of Martin Luther King in early 1968. I was awaiting sentencing for the Baltimore Customs House action when we drew together, several of us, the Catonsville Nine, and we went to a suburb of Baltimore, and we this time took the 1A files out of the draft boards there and burned them in a parking lot outside.
The Catonsville Nine was one of the defining actions of the movement against the Vietnam War. The image of nine Americans, two of them Catholic priests, burning a pile of over 600 draft files with homemade napalm shocked the country.
For this, I was given a six-year sentence and was denied bail and went to jail in May of 1968. I was released on bail about Christmas time of 1968 and then began to work solidly against the war, participating with friends in the formation of draft board raiding groups, nonviolent raiding groups, and did this until ordered to surrender in April of 1970. My brother, myself, George Mishy, and Mary Moyland at this point went underground.
While he was underground, Phil made a recording explaining his reasoning for refusing to report to prison. The tape was played on Pacifica station WBAI in April of 1970.
We have trouble with surrender even as we have trouble with official notions of crime or justice. Because this government refuses to represent the poor or blacks or students, it does not represent us. If it were truly representative, we would not be sent to jail. nor would it suppress our black brothers and sisters, and send to battlefield murder or to death our young brothers, and then suck dry for profit's sake our poor brothers here and abroad. And so it becomes a problem to us, as it has to the remainder of the world, placing us all in a common dilemma of survival.
Phil was caught by the FBI after 2 weeks.
I started serving my time at Lewisburg Penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and was there until August or September of that year when I was switched to Danbury, a federal institution in Danbury, Connecticut, and was there for the next 2.5 to 3 years.
Even after the end of the Vietnam War, Berrigan continued his active resistance to U.S. militarism and nuclear weapons. He estimates he took part in over 100 actions in the next 40 years. In 1980, he, along with 7 others, started the International Plowshares Disarmament Movement when they entered a General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
We had friends up in Media, PA, that had been demonstrating at Plant Number 9, General Electric, for about 2 years. So they suggested that the prophecy of Isaiah might be implemented there, and it was a completely new idea to us that we would be expected to take the initiative when the government wasn't willing to do that and beat swords into plowshares, beat nuclear weapons into scrap. We knew nothing about the guts of the plant, what the layout was. In any event, we tried to go in with the workers at about 7 a.m. Two of our number distracted the guard in the vestibule of the plant, and then others filed into the plant proper. And it took us about 10 seconds. John Chouchard went into a non-destructible testing room there, and there they were. So we began to work on them immediately, and then it broadened out a bit, and we were pouring blood on classified blueprints, and we were destroying tools that had been specially made to work on the Mark 12A. I think faith has a great deal to do with always finding the weapons and always doing what you intend to do to them, because they're so anti-human, and because the God we try to be faithful to is all about the human. We say God is a God of compassion.
We say that these are annihilatory weapons. They're true weapons of mass destruction. And we believe that they're the taproot of violence in the West here, because any people who would make the decision and would learn to love the company of the bomb and its use in certain circumstances against another people are mad. And we still haven't been able to understand, you know, the psychic or the spiritual effect of loving the bomb here in this country. And that's one of the things you free yourself of when you do a plowshares action. You no longer love the bomb. You've taken some measures against it. Yet you're saying, look, I won't pay for it. I won't work on it. See, I won't feed it with my silence. I won't remain passive while it exists. You're saying all those things, and you're liberating yourself from that bomb.
Philip Berrigan married Liz McAllister, and together they started Jonah House, a Catholic community in Baltimore, Maryland, dedicated to resisting nuclear weapons.
It's a nonviolent, very simply, a nonviolent resistance community. We don't say one of our priorities is serving the poor, though we do an awful lot of work in behalf of the poor. We hold all things in common. We practice voluntary poverty. We work with our hands to earn what we need for our living and our work. And that means supporting any effort towards resistance and peace. And it's been that way now since 1973. The community has paid quite a sizable price, not only in actions, but also in jail time. We speak of a revolving door between prison and what we call minimum security, which is living in this society.
Along with community, Phil saw the need for a deeply committed peace movement.
You know, you don't build a movement without people. You don't have a movement unless essential education, both moral and political, of a very, very high quality is extended. Building a movement or building a revolution is essentially a community operation, as I see it. So there again, I would focus on a politics that would build a movement, because it would influence people, bring them to a higher level of consciousness and a higher degree of risk in their lives, realizing that their identity is impossible unless they take risk for their brothers.
In one of the last interviews he gave, Phil was optimistic about the growing movement against the possible U.S. war on Iraq.
Very, very, very hopeful. Very hopeful. Because, you know, we all experienced 9/11, and we did realize the plurality that Bush had by way of support. And we did see the country go crazy with flags and all of that. Well, now a lot of that is being taken back. And people are beginning to, in a very sobering and responsible way, they're beginning to rock back on their heels and say, there's something fishy about this. And, of course, the fishiest thing is the war on terrorism, which is a big swindle. It's not a war on terrorism at all. A war on terrorism by the United States is impossible because we're the number one terrorists. It's impossible, absolutely impossible.
As we hold up Philip Berrigan, we mustn't leave out the many who accompanied him on his journey, the folks who went to prison with him, the many who've been a part of the Jonah House community, his partner Liz McAllister, and their three children who know all too well the challenges of a life of resistance. As he passes, may his vision and life assist us in finding our own paths to creating a nonviolent world.
And all my country saw were priests who broke the law. First it was a question, then it was a mission. How to be American, how to be a Christian.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Laurel Padgett-Seekins with help from Scott Gurian.
Peace Watch will produce an hour-long special on Phil Berrigan on Christmas Day. Thanks to Jim Goodnow and Radio for Peace International, Tom Lewis, Brian DeShazer of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill of Democracy Now! For providing audio for this piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA and Peace Watch intern Marcus Tyler Brown. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.